Welcome to On Spec. This is Fariba Nawa, your host. Climate change poses an existential threat to the planet, and more people are protesting about it.
How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones.
In the global north, it may be the future that's at stake, but elsewhere, it's the present.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
We are the Middle East is at the forefront of climate change. The Arab Spring is not over. In a lot of places, popular anger continues to break out at governments because they are failing to meet people's basic needs to live. Protests have returned to fill the streets of Beirut. When the political class dared trying to raise taxes, the Lebanese showed they weren't having it. The country's literally burning, forest fires rage, and public services were woefully unprepared to face them. In Egypt, the government has become more repressive since the 2011 revolution, as the government invests in mega projects instead of poor farmers. Yet Egyptians are showing dissent, and in Iraq, water is still at the center of it all. Remember that Iraq is the birthplace of human civilization. It's where agriculture first grew out of using aqueducts to transport water for farming. The Fertile Crescent between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Iraq's contemporary history is fraught with violence. Iraqis have survived one conflict after another, from Saddam Hussein's dictatorship to the US occupation and civil war, and later, the brutal rule of Islamic State. Sean Carrier is a journalist who's worked in the Middle East since the Arab Spring began. He's bringing us a story about the most important resource in life, water, and what happens when you turn on the faucet and get nothing but dirty water. It's enough to make you want to overthrow your government.
When most people think of Iraq, they think of the thousands of years of rich history, poets, the magnificent sculptures of the ancient Assyrian Empire. Anybody? No? Okay, fine. When most people think of Iraq, they think of war, suicide bombings, and oil. My name's Sean Carrier. I'm an American journalist who grew up and went to school in New York City. It was my first week of middle school in Manhattan when I looked up at the sky and thought that bombs would fall on our heads next. 9/11. Most of what I remember being told about Iraq in school was that it was a dangerous, faraway place that was always at war. The root causes of the conflict are never really made clear to us in school, but I always used to think, how do regular people live their lives? What are their daily worries and concerns? How do they feel about living through a war zone? And what causes those conflicts? It never really occurs to us that man-made destruction of the planet can contribute to these seemingly never-ending conflicts. But when you connect the dots and see how the daily tasks of Iraqi people's lives, like taking a shower, become a struggle, and at the same time they see their politicians on TV talking about how there's not enough money to fix the pipes, you can start to see how a climate disaster can sow the seeds for a political upheaval. When thousands of protesters took to the streets to demand change, they actually succeeded in bringing down the Iraqi government. But it wasn't ISIS or sectarian conflict at the root of the problem. It was water. How could climate change, protests, and toxic corruption bring down a government? I went looking for answers in a pile of trash.
So we are at the city dump right outside Sulaymaniyah. It's just a dump. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. There's just not just even in piles, but there's just trash everywhere. We're just walking through a field of trash.
And this, it's enormous. It's
outside Sulaymaniyah in northwestern Iraq is the biggest dump in the country. Trucks stream in from miles around, dropping load after load as a giant bulldozer rakes around an avalanche of junk as far as the eye can see. And running right through the glacier of garbage is a river. Its water is a filthy, putrid green color mixed with black oil. It smells like a gargoyle barfed up an expired pastrami sandwich soaked in gasoline.
To be honest, this is like a bad dream, basically, what they have done to this area. And
that's Nabil Musa. He's part of a band of environmentalists called the Water Keepers. They're local men and women who've been trying to raise awareness about the dangers of poisoning Iraq's waterways.
So I'll show you in a minute. This valley been used for the oil companies just to dump in their waste, like asphalt and all the nasty stuff from their waste, and dump it in here. And because of the city dumps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, the valley is no longer a valley. You can see all the factories over there. This is all factories and oil refineries and gravel mines, recycling companies, block factories.
There's no security or even a gate around the dump. So there's nothing stopping oil refineries from throwing their petroleum waste here. And there's enough of it that the putrid ooze seeps directly into the Tandaro River.
Nothing living in it and just pure toxic liquid, basically, we dump to the river. And this water, the problem, oh, look at this. Look at this.
This is all oil.
This is all oil. Oh, this is really scary brown. It's not a very happy color. And you can see there's no plants or anything in it, nothing life. This is really bad. And no way you want to go into.
With the government looking the other way, there's pretty much nobody except people like Nabil to be a watchdog. He's sounding the alarm about the devastating effects that this pollution is having. The toxic corruption isn't just destroying the region's natural beauty. It's also destroying people's livelihoods.
I actually been documenting this area for the last 10 years. This used to be an agriculture area, but this water is so bad. No longer farmers, they can use it for agriculture at all. And if you want, we can interview some farmers when we go down. They really, really suffer, like they say.
In the village of Karagol, just about every face we pass by greets Nabil with a smile. They invite him to their homes for dinner. People respect him because they know he's really looking out for them. He's not like the politicians who come by and promise a quick fix.
I'm not scared of the politicians. I don't give a shit about them.
Star Rahim Mahmoud overhears our conversation. He looks like your typical Kurdish farmer, the distinctive mustachioed face, wearing all black with the traditional Kurdi baggy pants, and a dash of flair with a pink flower print sash tied around his waist, and he smokes slim cigarettes, which are all considered very manly in Iraq.
If it's not corruption, then tell me why this water 15 years ago was crystal clean and beautiful, and it's turned to this? We want the life pack that we used to have. And I want to have a sustainable and healthy lifestyle for my kids. My life has already been destroyed. We don't trust the people who run the system. You gotta just take out this government and bring a new system. It's just two giant companies that took all the wealth from this country.
The two companies he's referring to are the Barzani and Talabani families. Like the Sopranos and the Corleones, two rival dynasties control everything under the sun in this part of the country. The Kurdistan regional government is semi-independent from the central government in Baghdad. Just about every top position is held by a Talabani or a Barzani. People are proud of their Kurdish identity, but for all the politicians' talk about independence, the people holding the power aren't even cleaning up their own backyard. Agriculture is a major industry in Iraq, and with the climate getting drier and hotter, farmers like Star Rahim were hit the hardest.
And this is where climate change meets politics. Drought meant less water for the farmers. Less water meant a weak harvest. And a weak harvest meant that prices soared. The first protests were over the rising price of eggs. And when subsidies to farmers got cut, they joined the protest too. More than half of Iraqi families have at least one person working for the government. And during the crisis, government austerity measures meant that public employees stopped getting their paychecks for months. So instead of going to work, teachers, nurses, went out to protest.
They kept up campaigns and protests, but nothing changed. Meanwhile, the problem did start to flow downstream, all the way down to the southern Basra province, Iraq's oil production heartland.
Today, the modern port of Basra is Iraq's waterway to the world. Ships laden with the goods of the new age sail out from the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean and the Far Orient. Here, amid lakes and marshes, water has created a way of life all its own.
Some say the marshes of southern Iraq are where the mythological Garden of Eden once stood. Basra used to be called the Venice of the Middle East for the ornate canals that run through the city. Now, they're a garbage dump.
Well, water was always a problem in Basra. It's always a problem in Basra.
That's Tamara Atiya, an archaeology student at a Basra university which dates back to the 13th century. It was founded around the same time as Oxford and Cambridge. Her parents used to tell her stories of how beautiful Basra used to be and how different their child was from hers.
I remember since I was little, we were using RO water, which is water purified in a certain technology for drinking. Now, what we have done as, you know, in my family's house, we started to use the RO water for washing the dishes, for washing and cleaning. Now, some families, even they link the RO water into their houses. So they would wash, have shower, do everything in the RO water. That's for sure something that not all families can do.
Few Iraqis can afford to buy that purified bottled RO water. Water treatment plants became overloaded, and tons of salt got backed up into the water. So when Tamara went to take a shower,
you know, I tasted the water and I really felt that it was really, really salty. And it burned my eyes. And for example, if I would take a shower, I would have, you know, the RO water with me after I finish. I just spill it over me just to get rid of the salt. I was very mad because, you know, the first thing all the time when you are in another country and you see how these countries are moving forward, developing their structures, and you see Iraq with its with these problems. So the first thing, I was really mad.
It's summer 2018. The thermometer hit 50 degrees Celsius. That's 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Water levels hit their lowest since 1931. The Tigris was so low that at some parts you could walk across it. And if the heat wasn't bad enough, people started getting sick from the filthy water that was coming from their faucets. 50,000 people were hospitalized. Next thing, the electricity went out. And when the air conditioner stopped, that's when people really lost their patience. Nobody knows how the first protest got started. Some say it was a group of young guys who had just been denied jobs at the oil fields. Oil generates billions of dollars for Iraq, but most of the country's poor residents never see that wealth. Instead, they're stuck with failing infrastructure. People say an argument turned into a shouting match, and the next thing you know, protests were tearing through the streets.
So after the protesting started, there were out in the streets mostly young men activists, ordinary young men who were, you know, mad because of the situation in Basra. We have problems of unemployment, in spite the city is having a lot of resources, but there is a big problem of unemployment in Basra. All of these things had made these young men to go out in the streets and to protest and demand their rights. And you have known and seen what happened after that. There were many killings of young, innocent people.
Dozens of people were killed when security forces shot live bullets into crowds. The protests raged for months. They couldn't have come at a worse time for Iraq's Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi. He just barely survived the nationwide elections in May, and his ruling party lost half of its support. At first, people had credited the government with leading the battle to defeat ISIS, but that doesn't mean much when it's scorching hot out and your air conditioner is failing. People felt that the government was just out of touch. Tamara explains.
People who were in hospitals who were poisoned with the water. But the problem was there were no official came out to talk about the issue in details, in exact facts and exact numbers. No official, no institution have done this. I saw only like social media.
The summer heat and the protest intensified. The protesters shut down the port of Basra, Iraq's only access to the sea where oil is exported.
The uprising was starting to hit the government where it hurts, in the wallet. Prime Minister Abadi had to resign and dissolve his government. A new government came into power on the promise of reforms. But as summer rolled around again in 2019, it was the same story all over again. Protesters returned to the streets of Baghdad and were met with more violent repression. Over 200 people lost their lives when they went out to protest, and the army was sent out to quell the unrest. This time, they demanded the whole regime get out. The protests put water and electricity at the top of the political agenda. The new government has promised reforms, infrastructure updates, and jobs for the youth. 58% of the population is under age 25. But it's the youth, like 22-year-old Tamara, who clearly don't believe in the promises of the old guard of corrupt politicians anymore, as they watch them get rich while the country goes broke.
What I see as hope is the new generation. I really do believe the new generation. Those people who were, let's say they were raised up after the war, they are aware right now. They are open to different resources. This is something that...
Greta Thunberg made it all the way to the world stage with a message to listen to the youth of the world, who are the ones whose futures are at stake. The movement she started spread all across Europe and America. But Iraqis are protesting too. When their country is brought up at the United Nations, it's usually in Security Council debates with other countries deciding Iraq's future. In the meantime, a new generation of Iraqi activists is already making their voices heard. In Iraq, this is Sean Carrier on SPEC.
So Sean, why did you decide to go to Iraq?
I've always wanted to cover war and conflict, not because I'm addicted to it, but rather from the perspective of the average person, how they're affected and living through a conflict. So when I went to Iraq, I really wanted to go in with an open mind and just listen to people without any pre-written story in my mind. I just wanted to go there and tell a true story about real people.
Yeah, but most people go there and talk about ISIS and bombs and bullets, clickbait topics. Why did you focus on water?
So I decided to become a journalist at a really exciting time back in the Arab Spring days when we used to refer to things like Facebook revolutions and we all thought that Twitter was going to somehow like bring democracy and great public discussions to the world.
Wait, can we go back to water? Sean has a tendency to diverge.
Okay, so I have a pretty political background from my university years, and I had read a lot about this notion that many of the major turning points in history, like social upheavals and revolutions, actually coincide with environmental crises that can be linked to climate change. So there's this idea that a chain reaction can happen where a drought causes a water shortage and then a food shortage, which creates economic problems and then basically brings about political upheaval, which you can basically creates this domino effect where you can see climate change becomes the catalyst for a revolution. And you can actually see this in a lot of the countries that the Arab Spring came to.
Those are some big overarching issues that you're sort of generalizing and putting together. And I'm curious to see, like, what did you find in Iraq that what surprised you?
So when I was first going to Iraq, I was nervous. Being this American journalist, I felt this huge burden on me, like I was going to do a bad job. I didn't know how people would see me. And was I going to, you know, show an accurate picture of the country, or was I only going to show like what the military wanted me to show? And the first thing that surprised me was how incredibly friendly Iraqi people are. And they're just genuinely really glad to meet you and really glad to help you. I've actually found it's the easiest place to work as a journalist. And also, there's so much natural beauty there. There's green forests, there's mountains and trees and streams and whitewater rafting in these rivers.
So how did you come across this water story?
I was actually hanging around a lot of the young people, and they were really interested in nature. And as I was just going around and having a great time meeting people, everybody said, like, you've got to meet this guy, Nabil. Like, and everyone kept telling me, you've got to meet Nabil. So I didn't know what to expect from him. But when I met him, he's just this funny and friendly guy who he's so passionate about nature. That's just his whole personality. And he's really devoted his life to just getting people to really think about how they treat the environment.
Just brings us back to the basics of life and how lucky we are to sit here and have access to water in Turkey.
I want to say thank you. I'm so glad. Turkey is so great. We have water. Thank you, Turkey. We love you, Turkey.
So how do people see this government and its handling of the water crisis?
The pressure is really on the government now. I mean, since ISIS has been mostly defeated, of course, we can't say completely defeated. Don't listen to Trump. Even though they don't control huge parts of the country anymore, they're still able to conduct attacks in Iraq. So the biggest phase of the war is now over. People's attention now is really on the services, because they're saying, like, okay, you can, you know, go to war and defeat ISIS and level cities in order to go to war against them. Like, how come you can't just get the water running? So people are really kind of putting their attention on this widespread corruption that's so pervasive in Iraqi politics. And, you know, every politician really jumps on the bandwagon and say, I'm so anti-corruption and everyone's corrupt except for me, of course. And people are pretty fed up with that. They're kind of becoming aware of that and saying, look, just stop blaming everyone else and just get our water running, please.
So how did ISIS take care of things with water?
Well, people were always pretty disappointed with the previous Iraqi government. So the bar for success was not very high. Just doing the bare minimum was pretty satisfactory to people. ISIS actually improved a lot of the services that weren't running very well. I mean, they very effectively used fear and kept people in their jobs who were working in the water and electrical department. So turns out that people work pretty hard when they have a gun to their back. They also did things like hold the Dam of Mosul and basically use it as a threat of a weapon of mass destruction, because if they threatened to blow up the reservoir, which would basically unleash a flood and probably kill a million people with the flood, which would just completely destroy the surrounding areas.
But they never did that, right?
They didn't do that, but they actually controlled the dam, and they actually had to get help from engineers, and they had to like bring in engineers to control this dam, because
they didn't have the expertise.
They didn't have the experts there who actually knew how to make sure a reservoir wouldn't like crack and flood and fall to pieces.
What's something you did while reporting the story that stayed with you, like a memorable story you can tell at dinner parties?
So my favorite story, if you've ever been to Iraq, you know that life is pretty much run by these checkpoints. And everywhere you go, there's different groups that control different checkpoints, whether it's Iraqi army or Kurdish Peshmerga or one of the many different militia groups. And anywhere that you go, especially if it's outside a city, you've got to cross three or four checkpoints. So people hate checkpoints. And not a lot of people know this, but in the very first days when ISIS first came into Mosul, the first thing that they did was get rid of all these checkpoints, and actually people were pretty excited and pretty much welcomed them. This was way before anybody knew that they were going to turn out to be this murderous death cult with a really violent interpretation of Islam, but it wasn't really that threatening for people to say like, hey brother, you're Muslim, I'm Muslim, like this government sucks, right? We should do something about it. Like, yeah, you know, this democracy and like secular government, totally not working. We should have like an Islamic state, right? Yeah. And we all know how that played out, but. Right. So anyway, there's this one checkpoint on the road between Erbil and Mosul where you change over from the Kurdish territory to the Iraqi army. And usually the Kurdish guards are really friendly. They really love Americans. In fact, they really love George Bush, which is strange to me because, you know, he invaded Iraq, but it actually kind of worked out pretty well for them. So Kurdish soldiers are usually pretty friendly when they see you. But this one time coming back from Mosul with our colleague Pesha, the Kurdish checkpoint guards, they made us get out of the car and took us back behind the checkpoint to talk to the commander. So we walk into this courtyard and we see this man spray painting stuff on the wall, like with red spray paint, just like this random weird slogans like go Peshmerga go and follow your dreams and like all these inspirational quotes on the wall. And so we walk up to him and he says like, hi, who are you? And I said, hi, I'm Sean Cartier. I'm a journalist. I'd like to cross your checkpoint. And he's all smiling and chatty. He's like, where are you from? I'm from New York. Oh, that's so great. I love New York. I went there. I love the pizza. Where'd you go to the university? I went to NYU. Oh, NYU, Washington Square Park. That's so cool. Great to meet you. You don't have permission to cross my checkpoint. And he just switched. And like, he just like two-faced. And we were like, and he was like, no, it's gonna be fine. We're gonna have fun together. Like, you can stay here and hang out with me. I'm never gonna let you leave here. I kept a journalist here 3 days once. I'm never gonna let you see the light of day.
Did you ever make it across the checkpoint?
So like, I mean, he just kept doing this crazy, friendly and menacing two-face thing. And eventually we just like frantically started texting everybody that we know, like, get us out of here. And then he eventually like got some call from someone and was like, yeah, just let them go. And I don't know if he was just messing with us and using his power or if he was just not qualified to be a checkpoint commander. But yeah, that's one of my craziest checkpoint stories. And pretty much every journalist who works in these kind of war zones has a crazy checkpoint story like that.
That's really entertaining, Sean. Thanks. Okay, so here's where I'm at next. In different parts of Iraq, Iraq is basically three different regions and regimes in a way, right? You have the Shiites in Basra, you have the Sunnis and the Sunni Arabs in the middle in Baghdad, and then you have the Kurdish areas in the north. Does anybody have more water than the other? How do they compete for this water? And you've been to all parts of Iraq, in the Kurdish areas, in the Sunni Arab areas, and in the Shia areas. And in each part, each group thinks they have more access to water, but what's the reality? How would you compare these parts with different regimes controlling water resources?
In the different parts of Iraq, people love to blame the other. The Kurdish government likes to blame Baghdad for all its problems, and Baghdad is in the Shia majority south, which blames the Sunnis for bringing ISIS and other things. And then, of course, the Sunnis say that they're discriminated against because they're in minority. When it comes to water, the reality is that the Kurdish region is more green, it's higher up in the mountains, it's less hot, it's also upstream, so they do get more water from the Tigris and Euphrates coming from Turkey. But they say that since Turkey is building these new dams which cut off the water further downstream, I mean, it's all really political, basically.
So did you find the answer you went looking for about climate change and how it can be a catalyst for social upheavals?
I think that moving into the 21st century, water resources are going to become more and more scarce, and we're going to see water shortages continue to be at the root of huge economic and social crises like famine and migration. I mean, if they can't farm and get water where they live, then they're going to migrate elsewhere. And so
you're going to see city populations overflowing, and it's going to cause a huge strain on the grid and on the infrastructure that we have. So this is going to be a huge problem. And even though it seems like an afterthought for most governments, they're really going to have to start thinking about how to manage this water issue so that it's fairly distributed and it's not something that people fight over, but they actually treat it like an essential resource for life.
It all comes down to power, doesn't it?
It all comes down to power and to politics. I mean, countries are going to have to work together, not against each other. But I think that this story really shows it's really about rich and poor, and about whether the people making decisions in a country are listening to the people who are affected by those decisions. Things are changing in Iraq, though. People are really tired of the same old stuff that they hear from the political class. And I really hear in the Iraqi youth that they're full of ideas and they're really ready to replace the old guard. I mean, pretty much nobody that you talk to in Iraq has a lot of faith in the old class of politicians.
But of course, like everywhere, they won't go without a fight. I mean, my last question, to boil it all down, is does every Iraqi have access to clean water? Can they have a drink of water every day without getting sick?
It's really sad to see that Iraq, which is a place that has this history, was the first place in civilization to develop irrigation, the ability to move water around and store it. And today it's being trucked around and shipped in plastic bottles everywhere. So, you know, if you have money, you have access to clean water. And if you don't, then you turn on the sink and you use this water not knowing how clean it is. And it's pretty expensive. Like everywhere in the world, it's pretty expensive to be poor. And like, if you're living on $10 a day and then a water crisis happens and you have to start paying to have it shipped to you, which means you're spending more of your income. And, you know, this is something that should just be part of a basic service. So I think, unfortunately, what we're going to see is more privatization, more, instead of public infrastructure, people are going to have to just pay out of pocket for private companies to deliver them the things that they need. And, you know, we're already seeing that Iraq just announced it's going to be taking out a loan from the World Bank to update its electricity grid. So that's going to be a loan that people are going to have to pay back. And it's going to be the corrupt politicians who are going to be responsible for making sure the money goes where it's supposed to. And they don't have a good track record of that.
Okay. It was a pleasure to discuss Iraq with you, Sean. Join us for the next episode of On Spec, where you can hear stories that bring you closer to the globe. This is Fari Banawa, your host.